Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Illustration Department Podcast. My name is Giuseppe Castellano. In this podcast, I talk to folks in illustration, graphic design, publishing, animation, and other creative fields about their work, the lessons they've learned, and the bumps and bruises they've experienced along the way. In this episode, my guest is Francis Suping Chow, VP and Creative Director for Running Press and Black Dog and Lemonthal. When you email your portfolio to an art director or any art buyer, you are not bothering them. As Francis explains, that email is a key component of being a working illustrator. Among other topics, Francis talks about her role and her time at Running Press. We discuss what words illustrators should never use when submitting portfolios to art directors, and Francis and I explain why illustrators should focus less on style and more on quality. I hope you enjoy our conversation. What is it about public speaking that is anxiety-inducing?
I am not an anxious person. Well, I never thought I was until recently. Uh-huh. Everything about it, it's, you know, are you going to use proper English? I grew up in the Caribbean. We use slang a lot. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you're always conscious of is, am I using the Queen's English? So that's always in the back of my mind. Am I babbling and sounding like an idiot? Or am I saying something that people understand? Because mm-hmm. I find a lot of times if you don't prepare, you're really trying to formulate your thoughts while you're verbalizing. Oh. And that can just create...
mistake.
Yeah, that can mm-hmm. just create a lot of stress. So, oh, yeah. And I tend to procrastinate getting ready for stuff like this. So,
you and me both, Francis.
You know, I'm not the best with preparation. And sometimes I think, oh, I'll just wing it. I'll be fine. And then I get into the space and I'm not in the correct mind space at all.
Right.
So there's always that fear that it will happen.
I learned pretty quickly when I started doing talks at conferences that I am a nervous speaker initially, you know, like wow. My hands get cold. My yes. voice gets tight. Mm-hmm. I get a little shaky. It took me many speaking engagements and many years to finally like get over it. And I think the key for me was simply just, you know what? Maybe I'll say something stupid, but guess what? Whatever, man. There's like a lot of worse things to worry about in this world than just saying something dumb. And the chances of you saying something dumb, especially if you, like you, working in publishing for as long as you have, about publishing, those chances are minimal, if not entirely well, zero.
That makes me feel better. I always turn to humor as well. Mm. I think I'm funny. Other people may not, but I crack myself up all the time. And I'm constantly thinking of stuff like that in the background.
Right.
And, you know, it's funny because my manager... is something's like, oh God, please don't say that, you know, because right. it's always, I'm always a person who will like spew out the most inappropriate thing. So
oh,
I have to
man.
Be careful.
That was my worry too. Like when I was working at Penguin, we'd have so many conference room meetings and mm-hmm. just with a publisher and with guests and authors and just, and every single time I said one thing that I regretted every single time. And it wasn't inappropriate. It was just a dumb statement or a bad attempt at a joke that no one
yes.
got.
Yeah.
And then it's that one thing you say in a 1 hour long conversation, you walk away from the conference room and you're just shaking your head going like, God damn it. Why did I say that? Anyway,
I can definitely appreciate that.
Speaking of being in public, mm-hmm. in April of 2011, were you in an episode of Real Housewives of New Jersey?
Oh my God. I'm like, what could you possibly be referring to April of 2011? Yes, I was actually in, I think, two episodes. The editorial director and I were doing a book with Teresa Giudice.
Yeah. Right.
Or Giudice, depending on,
Giudice.
I guess, where you're from and how you want to pronounce
Sono italiano.
It. She was never clear on how she wanted us to pronounce it, but she was lovely to work with. And uh-huh. it was my first first and only, I hope, ever, you know, foray into reality TV. And the entire time we were on our guard going, do not, and I do not have poker face. I show everything. And I was like, straight poker face. Don't roll your eyes. Don't say anything. Don't even breathe loudly. And of course, they caught us a few times after, like, making comments and rolling our eyes, and they kind of edited it to create more drama. It was quite a funny episode.
You wouldn't happen to have a link to that episode, would you?
I would have to look for it. Okay. Maybe.
All right.
Maybe.
You're going to have to send that to me. I'm going to put it in the show notes. No, I'm kidding. Oh, my gosh.
She mispronounced something, and I don't remember what it was. It was a little risque, and they supposedly panned to us, and we were both like, what the hell? And we did not make that face, because as soon as I heard it, I was just like, don't react.
Oh, God. She was talking about Puccini. She mispronounced Puccini.
No, it was something.
You're like, what'd you say?
It was an herb or something like that, and I can't remember what it was. I'll figure it out.
Well, I mean, for folks who are like, who the hell is Teresa Giudice? Or Judas, or whatever, however people want to pronounce it. She had a cookbook. I think it was maybe her first of two, I want to say, that came out around that time.
I think we did two or three. I'm losing track. And she was very involved in all of them.
It was called Fabulicious, Teresa's Italian Family Cookbook.
Yes.
Oh, my God. And then she and her husband, Joe, got into some tax evading issues.
Yes.
Maybe they got divorced, too. Filed for bankruptcy. So
I believe they did, and I believe he did time for it.
Nice
short stint. Yes.
Not that I ever watched an episode of that show. I just did a little research. That's all.
We had a watch party, so everyone laughed, and it was quite a cringy moment in my career.
Was it like, and in this episode, we have the publisher of the cookbook, you know, here's Francis. Like, was it, you were there because they were basically pitching
the cookbook? We were doing a photo shoot. So every time we were on, it was for a photo shoot. And when we first met her, they didn't give it. That was like the first take that they showed. And I was so anxious about it. You know, my last name's very long, and even though it seems fairly simple to me, Su Ping Chow,
right,
I tend to not say it when I'm introducing myself because I'm like, no one's going to remember that. So I introduced myself just as Francis, and a comedian, of all things, made a comment about it. Like, you're just Francis, like, Cher. And I was like, of all the things to focus on the show.
Well, the reason I know this is because there is an article out there that someone wrote about the episode. Like, this person's job for, I don't know what, some kind of blog, was just write recaps of episodes. And one of the things they said was, and did I just see someone on screen with the name Francis Su Ping Chow? What is going on here? Anyway, let me tell you about Teresa's baby and the thing that, her hat that fell off her head or something. Anyway, moving on. My parents are Italian immigrants, and so my mother is, of course, the best cook in the world, and I will fight anyone who says otherwise. My sisters and I are always like, Mom, write your recipes down. We're going to make a cookbook. It's going to be called From Nonna. That's it. Like, simple Southern Italian peasant food or something. And you'll be rich, and then we can all retire to, like, Southern Italy, you know? And she's like, no, I don't want to do that, no. It's only for you. Cook it for you. Yeah. Oh, she's awesome. Anyway, when did you come over to the States?
I came to go to college, gonna date myself, in 1989. I did 4 years at Tyler School of Art, graduated, did a very quick stint in New York, kind of at a, of all places, New York Life Insurance Company in their design department. Right. Didn't even know they had one. And
hey, man, job's a job.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I ended up coming back to Philly because one of my closest friends was working at a publishing company. and they needed a designer. So he introduced me to the art director. I interviewed, I got the position, and I've been there ever since.
What was that first job title at Running Press?
Book designer. Looking back, it was a pretty junior designer position, but right. we didn't break it out like that. So I've always been in the design department.
What year did you start there?
1993.
93.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's yes, exactly.
Sorry,
I was trying to do the math.
That's an ageist. Wow. Wow.
Yeah. That's fine. It's been an interesting. You know, everything evolves.
Oh, sure.
And whether it's for the better or for the worst, the company evolves. You know, I changed. I grew up. I like to tell people jokingly that Running Press stole my youth, but it really didn't. I mean, it was going to happen anyhow.
Sure.
But yeah, I worked through different publishers, different art directors. I became the art director. So it's definitely an environment that I've loved working in. If not, you know, I would never have stayed this long.
Right. You know, I interviewed with Running Press once.
Was it with me or was it with my boss?
It was with Chris Navratil.
Yes, Chris Navratil.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it was sometime in the late, I don't remember when, I was trying to remember, late 2000s, right around when my son was born. I wanted out of New York. I wanted more green space. I wanted to be closer to family because I'm from Baltimore.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. Yes. And anyway, it was an exploratory interview with Christopher. It obviously didn't go anywhere.
Well, I think I ended up becoming the creative director. So.
Yeah, he was like, we got Francis, bro. It's, you know, go back to New York where you belong.
Oh.
And it's all right. It's all right. I now live an hour from Philly. So it took 10 more years for us to get out of there.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we see a lot of, we actually have a lot of people that straddle Philadelphia and New York because we have offices in New York, obviously.
Sure.
We've had publishers that lived in New York and traveled down and stayed, you know, overnight, a few days a week. We've definitely had that happen.
Yeah. I mean, it's cheaper than New York. It's the second biggest city on the East Coast.
Yes.
You know, don't sleep on Philly, folks.
Hey, I love it. I've been here since 1989.
Do you live in the city or outside of the city?
I was in the city for about just over 12 years, and I just moved to the suburbs.
Nice.
I moved last during the pandemic when everything was going crazy and people were like, oh, we've had enough, and we're all moving. I did the same.
Yeah, that's what we did.
And got a little house in just on the outskirts of Manayunk with a backyard, and I knew nothing about having a yard or mowing a lawn. I broke the lawnmower the first time I mowed the lawn.
Did you break it with a baseball bat or another way?
No, I ran over the cord. First of all, I ran over the cord. The second time, I ran over stones and just sucked them all up into the lawnmower.
All right, so Francis, you might want to just spend a couple bucks on a on a kid in the neighborhood. Just do it. Yeah, have them do it.
I'll figure it out.
I mean, you almost electrocuted yourself.
Well, thank God for the surge protectors.
Yeah, exactly. Today, your title there now is VP and Creative Director of Running Press and Black Dog Ampersand Leventhal. I was going to say and Black Dog and Leventhal, but that just sounded weird.
Yes.
It's Black Dog and Leventhal and Running Press.
Yes. I oversee all creative content for all five. Black Dog is an imprint of Running Press, and we have four other imprints that are all under Running Press.
Which are?
So there are five imprints total. There's Running Press, which is the adult imprint, RP Studio, the, I would say, stationery, which includes anything from tarot decks, puzzles, journals, Running Press Kids, which I tend to focus on the most, and RP Minis, which is a miniature edition line.
How much has Running Press Kids specifically, grown since you've been there?
Wow. I can't remember exactly when we started. Running Press Kids was not there when I first started. I think we probably created it maybe 15 years ago. It's really evolved. This is something that happens with publishing. The focus on of the kids' imprint changes depending on who the editorial director is, who the publisher is, were very collaborative in like brainstorming for that imprint. You know, whether we're doing picture books, board books, middle grade novels, young adult novels, you know, nonfiction titles. And I would say it's grown significantly. Our entire list is constantly growing. When I first started, I think I was doing 4 books a season. Now I'm probably doing anywhere from 8 to 10 a season, you know, which is a significant workload when you're also overseeing the creative end of the company.
Right. And that's just you. That's not all of the 5 imprints combined. How many books a year, more or less, is coming out of Running Press?
Probably going to get this number completely wrong.
That's okay.
I would say, since we switched to 3 seasons and, you know, like the miniature edition imprint's probably doing about 15 to 20 books a season. So we're probably close to 200 plus.
Okay. You could have just said hundreds and you would have been right.
Yeah, hundreds, yes. And most of the books are done in-house, and we do both covers, interiors. We kind of do everything.
You do. I mean, you publish fiction, nonfiction, media tie-in, novelty, activity, and other types of books, adult, children, calendars. I mean, just all sorts of stuff. In terms of target audience, you have quite a range.
Yes.
I suspect zooming out that much with your lists, your 3 seasons, can be a challenge.
So what we've done is we have people that focus on each imprint specifically. They're kind of like the go-to staff members. So, you know, that's very typical on the editorial. And what I've done on my end is I have associate design directors that kind of, like, I have one for RP Studio, one for Black Dog and Leventhal, one for Running Press. And they really kind of oversee everything that's created under that umbrella. And of course, everyone reports back up to me.
Right. What would you say your team's focus is in terms of the kinds of books you publish? Would you say Running Press has a clear voice?
I think so. In some areas, it's stronger. You know, the miniature editions line has such a very distinct look because of the sizes of those packages. I think for the rest, we've really developed a look that we aspire to and try to keep consistent throughout the list. And, you know, I have 8 designers reporting up to me. I am only as strong as they are. And it's something I have to say, I have a really fantastic design department. They all have their pros and cons, what they're great at, and sometimes their weaknesses, but there aren't that many, and we're very collaborative. So there's a lot of back and forth. You know, we try to have designers mentor each other. So we're really kind of focusing on growing and developing, no matter what level you are. Even at my level, I still have designers oversee some of my stuff and, you know, give me input, like, does this suck? What would you, you know, because sometimes you're just too close to it.
Sure.
Sure. And we, you know, we're a trade publisher, so gift appeal is probably the highest thing on our agenda.
What's the highest thing on your list in terms of income? What is the largest income driver? You know, is it the kids' books? Is it the stationery stuff? Like, which adult?
Miniature editions.
Really?
Yes. I think from when I started, definitely when I started in 1993, so it predates me. We had an imprint called Miniature Editions, which we slowly evolved into RP Minis, and a few other publishers had them. And but we trademarked the book size. So all of the books are 2.5 by 3 inches.
Wow.
We had a lot
That's
of
like
them.
A barcode.
They were, they're quite fun to design. And we had display racks in Borders and Barnes & Noble, so very clear channels to sell to. And throughout the year, we came up with the idea to create mini kits. And this, oddly enough, stemmed from something that I created as a joke one Christmas, because we would have this Christmas party and we would decorate the tree. So we all had to make Christmas ornaments. Mm-hmm. And I decided to make a little box that had all of the very, probably not right for work at all. HR would not be happy, but all of the movie stars that I thought was, you know, were hot, I put in this.
Francis.
I don't know what I was thinking. Anyway.
Francis. I think HR just called.
So I had this box of hot men as my ornament, and the associate publisher saw it, and he was like, that gives me an idea. I was not thinking, this is going to be the next step in the RP mini line, but he clearly did, and he created this incredible line of new product for us to work with, and it just took off from there to the point where we now kind of control that area. A few of the publishers kind of backed out of it because we had such a strong foothold. And we do predominantly mini kits now, which can be anything. A lot of them tend to be licensed. Sometimes there's not even a book in it. It's really an interesting kind of thing that's taken off on its own. And everyone in the company gets involved. And I'm not just talking running press. We have people from Hachette Books, like completely different publishing companies, that weigh in and brainstorm and give us ideas.
Right. You know, when I was at Penguin, the publisher had an idea of this, like this, and I think he was using the Running Press minis as a template. Basically, the idea was take best-selling picture books and just make them, 3 inches by 4 inches.
Yes.
And put them on a counter display.
Yes.
At bookstores, Barnes & Noble, etc.
That sounds exactly like what we were doing.
Yeah. How do I say this kindly? Not a whole lot of original ideas coming out of that office. Let me just put it that way. It didn't last long. Maybe a couple seasons. Speaking of seasons, just for folks listening, like, what are seasons? What are the seasons? Like, where? What months are the seasons? Yeah, which ones do you do? Because different publishing houses obviously do things differently.
Yes, we were initially doing a spring season, which is fairly obvious. It's spring.
Sure.
And a fall season, which was kind of fall-winter. We switched to 3 seasons. And what that is we start off with a winter season, which oddly enough starts in like February, January area. It's a very short season. It's only about 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
The next season, summer, and that's kind of obvious when that time is. And the last season is fall, and that's your largest season because that has all of the holidays. You have Halloween and Christmas in there. And I believe that starts around August. And it's all based off of the sell date, what date the title publishes and shows up in the at the retailer.
I know this is like, it depends, because you're doing hundreds of books a year. In terms of seasons, when I was at Penguin, and even before that at Simon & Schuster, it would be for a winter season book, that comes out in January or February, we would be looking for, at the time, like, it got to the design desk right around a year prior. So we were always like hot and heavy looking for illustrators in February for the next season's winter books. We were looking for illustrators hot and heavy in May for the next season's summer, and hot and heavy in August for obviously the next season's fall. So it was always a year prior. Like, those were the 3 months that we're always looking for illustrators, always. But those 3 months, February, May, August, it was like go time.
It does. Yes. Yeah. It really depends on the book. Picture books they're just longer lead time. Not only for the illustrator to create, but you have to sell with either FNGs or finished books. So that means our sales force needs all of their content much earlier.
Sure.
It's pretty much format and sales related that affects our schedule. So we've realized for RP Studio, for example, if you're doing a tarot deck and you have 70 something cards or an oracle deck, that's just a lot of content for an illustrator to create. So we would start working on that hopefully a year out.
Okay.
For the miniature editions line, we're having the same issue because we have components that have to be sourced. And we have a fantastic production team that sources stuff, but sometimes things are being built, you know, like we're creating it and coming up with it and then trying to tell a vendor how to create this and how to make it work. And is it going to have sound? Something going to pop out of it? And there's a lot of back and forth. So we really need to start creating that stuff as early as possible.
Right.
What I found is because our list is so large, we're always looking for illustrators, and we do our own contracts. It's just like this constant sending out illustrator pitches, hiring illustrators, giving them art direction, working with them closely. The seasons also aren't separated. So you would hope that winter would be separated from fall, but typically what's happening is I'm working on, right now I'm working on fall 2023, winter 2024, summer 2024, and fall 2024. Because all of the seasons, depending on what the book is, you know, you could be working on them simultaneously.
Right. That's important to call out. We were always working on easily three seasons at a time.
It gets very confusing.
Yeah, exactly. When you're designing a Christmas book and it's like 92 degrees in August.
Or you're like, what year are we in? Is it 2024?
Oh, yeah, that happens too. You mentioned Hachette. When Hachette bought Perseus Books Group, which was the previous owner of Running Press, I guess they still are, and maybe Hachette is the owner of the owner?
Perseus, it's just a name alone.
All right.
We retained the Perseus Books Group when Hachette bought us, but Perseus was a much larger corporation. I believe when the head of Perseus passed away, and I could be wrong, the board of directors looked at the company as a whole and were trying to figure out what do we want to sell off, what do we want to focus on. They had their feet in kind of everything, and publishing was just one little small part of what they were doing.
And I think that was somewhere in the 2014 time.
Yes.
And then they ended up selling it in 2016 to Hachette.
Yeah.
What was your reaction?
You know, we didn't know what to expect. We'd heard of larger companies coming in and buying out smaller companies, because when I started at Running Press, it was a privately owned small company, very, you know, still being run like, you know, mom and pop shop type thing. Everyone was involved in everything. Everyone wore different hats. When Perseus bought us, that didn't really change a whole lot. There was some like, oh, yeah, if we're making a big acquisition, someone has to approve it in Perseus. But they kind of left us alone to publish what we wanted. So going into Hachette, we really thought, look, we really have to tighten up. And, you know, this is a big company and they're going to be watching us and we're going to... You know, all of these things that we've been doing and getting away with it, we can't do them anymore. But
you mean like hot guy books on Christmas trees, things like that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure I could get away with it if I tried. But yeah, it was not anywhere near as crazy as we thought it was going to be. First of all, the transition was slow. They kind of eased us into it. And I will say right off the bat, the first thing we got was brand new laptops. And the design department was like, hallelujah, no more. You know, I'm on InDesign this version. You're on InDesign another version. They really stepped up and made our life so much easier. So all of the new online servers and everything else we had to master, that part was traumatic. But the new software, the new laptops were fantastic.
And to pay for the laptops, they laid off the distribution team.
I hope not. You know, we still have to this day personnel that aren't found anywhere else in Hachette. Like, we have free press people that aren't really found in other imprints.
Right.
So we have someone who just makes dummies. That's not common in Hachette at all.
Oh, my God. I was the person that made dummies at Simon & Schuster. I was the assistant. That was my job.
Yeah.
Here, make like a stack of dummies for sales conference.
Exactly.
Like all day long.
Our sales force was very dummy hungry. So this was a full-time job. And, you know, it's starting back up. Like he's getting requests now since everyone's doing sales calls.
Right. Do you guys work from home permanently, temporarily?
We are on a hybrid. So 2 days a week in the office.
Mm-hmm.
I know in the New York office, they were very specific as to when each imprint goes in. So you have set days.
Mm-hmm.
At the Philly office,
makes sense.
My department's in Tuesdays and Wednesdays and with editorial and some other staff are in Wednesday and Thursday. So we all kind of, you know, stagger a little bit. But we moved office in the middle of the pandemic too, and we're in a much larger office. So it's a little strange at times because it can be empty.
Right. Well, on the subject of finding illustrators and the fact that you aren't really in the office all that much, you know, this comes up on the podcast from time to time, you know, this idea that like, do I send postcards anymore? Will they get my postcard?
No. I barely get mail.
What about your design staff?
We're probably getting, I think, maybe one thing a month. It's really cut down, like, significantly.
Sure.
We do most of our research online. We have a lot of agents that we use. Okay. We use Instagram a significant amount.
Of course.
Pinterest. But I would say between the agents and Instagram, that's probably where we're getting the majority of our illustrators.
I'm pretending to be an illustrator, and I just heard you say that.
Yes.
I don't have an agent.
That's fine.
So how do I get your attention? You're not going to get my postcard.
Well, no, but I do get things emailed to me a lot. That happens constantly. That's not a problem at all.
Pause. Say that one more time. That is not a what?
That is not a problem.
Okay.
To get.
Do you hear that, folks? Oh my God, Francis, I'm not kidding. Maybe once every couple days. I talk to illustrators every day, 5 days a week. Once every couple days. At minimum. Sometimes it's like every day. I'll talk to an illustrator and they'll say, well, I don't know. I don't want to bother them.
You're not.
You're not bothering anyone.
Worst case scenario, the email gets deleted or goes into junk mail.
Right.
Best case scenario, you catch our eye and, you know, I actually keep stuff and, you know, you would know this as well. You don't always have a job right away.
Exactly.
We're constantly looking for illustrators and I keep, I have a folder in my email that's just illustrator samples.
That's how I do it.
I refer to.
Mm-hmm.
And when something comes up and I can't find an illustrator, or sometimes I just go back into the folder and I dig around in it and I'm like, oh yeah, I remember this person.
Mm-hmm.
So please, it's the best way to stay on our list and to remind us, you know, that you're there and willing to do work.
As far as Instagram goes, and I really don't want to talk about social media today, honestly, so we're not. But as far as Instagram goes... Okay, so that sounds great. Okay, I'll email her. Awesome. When I post things to Instagram, how am I going to get your attention that way? Through hashtags? Do I tag you? Do I DM you? By the way, I know the answers to these, but I'd like to hear you say it.
For me personally, I find people. I don't think I've ever had anyone DM me.
Would that bother you?
I don't think so. I've had people try to friend me and the only reason, or to follow me, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason I don't accept it is I'm not great sharing work on Instagram. I'll follow them. Mm. Like I'll reach out and follow them. That's not a problem. But you know, honestly, my Instagram's me with my cats, with family. I don't think
your beat up lawnmower.
Yeah. I'm going to assume that no one else really wants to see that.
Hey, man, so, everyone's got different tastes.
I every time I get a request to follow, I'm just like, you're going to be so disappointed.
Speaking of disappointment, there's something that's been on my mind the past several weeks, and I'm just kind of like mulling it over. And that is with respect to querying or submitting your work to a publisher or to a creative director, art director, agent. There are three words that I think illustrators should never type: hope, wish, and love. 20 years of being an art director, I got plenty of emails, plenty of postcards, and plenty of times they said, it's always been my wish to work for Simon & Schuster.
Yeah.
I would love to work for Penguin. My hope is that we get to work together.
Yeah.
And I think those are three incredibly dangerous words because there's a desperation to it.
Yes.
You're not saying anything to an art director when you say, it's always been my dream, there's a fourth word, to work for Penguin. What is that supposed to, what am I supposed to get out of that?
I agree with you. It also harkens back to that idea that I'm sorry to everyone who has this dream.
Yeah, don't be sorry.
Not
we're talking real stuff here.
Can publish a children's book.
Agreed.
And that's probably the thing I get the most. I've always wanted to publish a children's book. And
that is a worthless sentence.
It is, because what does that mean? Like, I don't know if you realize that that doesn't suddenly mean you are, you know, Eric Carl or anyone, you know, some amazing children's book illustrator. There's so many picture books out there now. They get published and they die. And it's really unfortunate because it's always been my passion to work on them. I work with amazing illustrators who surprise me when they send me their artwork and I get excited about it, and you published it and you wish everyone could see it, and then they just kind of disappear because there's too many picture books out there.
Yeah.
So when you hear that, it really makes me think of, you know, this is my dream, but again, this sounds awful, but what can you do for me rather than what can I do for you? Because while I would love to help everyone, it's just not doable. It's and that's kind of sad.
It is, but it is reality. And I think everyone, what am I trying to say? I just think that we all need to not see this as this sort of precious thing. This, you know, you're destined to be published. It's a business, folks. It is a business. Yes, it's the best business, in my opinion, but it's still a damn business. And these folks, art directors, agents, editors, publishers, et cetera, are not in the business of granting wishes. And that's, I mean, that's it. I mean, it's a job, man. It's a job. Let's not be precious about it.
It is a job. I will say that is the kind of black and white. The emotional aspect for me is it's still a job that I love doing. I love, you know, like I mentioned previously, seeing that artwork, seeing an illustrator interpret stuff that I would not have created, sending that in. I mean, sometimes I'm blown away by what illustrators have created. And that to me is amazing. So I'm not always as concerned with, are we going to make money off of this? But my main concern is this the best illustration and illustrator I could have gotten for this project to make it what I want it to be?
Yeah. And I hope I'm not coming across as like uber harsh. I just want people to not be disappointed if it's not working out just yet.
Yeah.
They're spinning their wheels a little bit. They're trying to get the attention of people in the publishing industry, and it's just not quite working. You know, a few months have gone by, and they've been fed through certain conferences that it's all just like sunshine, rainbows, and puppy dogs. And it just fucking isn't. And,
no,
and what ends up happening is that they get jaded and cynical. Why? Is because they were fed this like super, you know, lollipops and whipped cream. And it's mm-hmm. just, it's a little bit of that. Of course. I mean, I literally cried. This is a true story. When I was at Penguin, we did a series of chapter books called Here's Hank. Mm-hmm. Long story short, it's about this kid who is dyslexic. Mm-hmm. And pre-diagnosed, we found a typeface that was easier for dyslexic folks to read. And fast forward, we saw videos. People were posting videos and letting us know that for the first time ever, their kid was reading a chapter book, and the words weren't turning on them.
Wow!
And that made us cry.
Yeah.
We were just like, us, this is amazing. This is why we do what we do. But this isn't the publishing industry of like the 1960s and 70s when like people were just like, I want to publish this book because I want to. You cannot have the dream, the lollipops, without the reality of it being a business. It's both.
Absolutely. I mean, the other thing is, it's like anything else in the world, there's so many great illustrators out there. You could be fantastic, but that doesn't mean you get selected. There's so much that goes into selecting mm-hmm. an illustrator, whose voice has to be heard, who gets to say whether or not this is a good option. And it varies from place to place. So sometimes it's a budget issue. There are a lot of factors that come into play with selecting an illustrator.
Right. So if they don't select you, don't automatically assume it's because they think you stink.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's probably like the least, you know, if there's a 10 reasons why illustrators get, quote, rejected or passed on or ignored, I would say the quality of your work not being there is probably, you know, in the bottom third of that list.
Yes.
The others are, we can't, you know, we just don't have the budget, or stylistically it isn't what we do, or the timing isn't right, and it goes on and on.
Yeah, I mean, stylistically, I think that's important because, and I've mentioned this to illustrators that I've critiqued before at conferences, you know, do some research on your end as well. Look at what the company has published. Mm-hmm. So if you're seeing a lot of nonfiction, then don't go to that company going, oh, I want to illustrate a board book. That they're going to ignore you, because mm-hmm. that's not what they do. So you really have to be familiar with what the company's publishing, this style of their work. Are they looking for, you know, very classic type of old-fashioned illustration, or do they want something more contemporary and graphic? All of that comes into play. And styles change constantly. So, mm-hmm. you know, each company evolves depending on trends. We have to do it. If not, we'll go out of business. Mm-hmm. So you really have to stay on top of what is working right now. Go to bookstores and look around.
And not just that, though. Like, yes, visit the bookstores. I also think you should be following these publishing. Every publishing company now has an Instagram page. Follow their Instagram page. You know, just keep tabs, keep tabs. You'll have a decent idea. Not the whole, you won't get the whole picture. You'll just have a decent idea.
Yes,
and it might help answer the question. Really, the main question I think that should be answered when illustrators are doing their, quote, doing their research, just look at what is getting published in terms of quality, specifically with illustration. We can also expand this to writing.
Yes.
You know, at the Society of Illustrators Original Art Show, which books were selected, and what art, what kind of art was celebrated and hung on the walls of the society. Yes. Not because you're looking at it going like, oh, I guess I have to draw kids now that look like this. It's not about that. It's about the quality of the art. And this is the hardest question, I think, for every illustrator to really face. Is the quality of my art on par with not the best illustrators out there, but with folks who are currently being published? This isn't about style. This is about quality. And
I agree.
That awareness is really, really challenging.
I agree with that. And I think it's something where you really have to take a close look, and it's not always easy. It's basically a self-criticism of their own artwork.
Right.
So, and that's sometimes difficult. I know you talked about this a while ago, where in the old days you could go into, you could do like an informative interview with an art director.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, no one really has the time to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. But if you can have people critiquing your artwork that are knowledgeable, or, and I'm not just saying, you know, take this to your family and say, is this good? Because it might not be the most objective opinion you could get, but I think it really helps sometimes to get objective, educated feedback on right. your artwork.
Yep, I agree. And try and get as many as you can. And here's something that someone told me recently, an illustrator. They're frustrated that there is all this conflicting advice out there that's getting floated around on social media, that you hear in conferences. She's completely mm-hmm. right. So what do you do about that? You read what the advice is, hear what the advice is. One person says blue, the next person says red. And just kind of trust your gut ultimately. Like, you make your own call about your own work. So if one art director says, you know what, you need to do X, and the next art director portfolio review says, you need to do Y, go back to your workspace and just reflect on, okay, well, does X feel better to me, or does Y feel better? Does that make more sense, yeah. or does that make more sense?
Oh, that applies to life, I think.
Oh, 100% does.
Everyone's going to give you conflicting advice.
I know, but you hear a lot of illustrators say, well, what should I be doing? That person says this, and what should I do? What should I do? What should I do?
Absolutely.
I feel like I just dumped a giant bucket of ice water on everybody. I don't know. I think reality and honesty is better than inflated
expectations.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, but on the other side of that, we do have illustrators who are being found by agents.
Mm-hmm.
There's some agents that do calls, and they have illustrators, you know, do workshops, things mm-hmm. like that, I think, get you involved in the industry and really get you feedback. And yeah, they're not free, but it really expands your, I think, your education into the industry and
Definitely.
What's involved in it.
Let's un-ice bucket everybody and provide some ray of sunshine in the form of one last piece of advice from you to illustrators and writers listening. What would you like to leave them with?
That's a good question. I think for me, with illustrators and writers, I mean, obviously anyone creative, is you really need to create from like your own experiences and your own interests. It's always obvious to me if someone's creating outside of their realm of comfort, and it becomes forced. So not that everything has to be too close to home, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen this all the time. I get pitches for something that's like, this is a storybook about my daughter going to school and her mishaps, and I'm like, I don't know who wants to. It's like me with the cats on Instagram. Who wants to see that? No one else but me and my family.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be careful about how self-involved your content is, but really do what you're familiar with and you love.
To learn more about Running Press, visit runningpress.com. If you find value in this podcast, please consider supporting it as a patron. Become a patron by visiting patreon.com/illustrationdept. In return, you can receive our soft enamel pin, a reusable discount code for 10% off, access to dozens of patron-only episodes we call Extra Credit, and more. This podcast is produced by the Illustration Department, a global leader in online education for illustrators. Visit illustrationdept.com for class offerings, testimonials, the alumni showcase, the podcast show notes, our forum, the bookshop, and more. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.